Here's the Fellowship's vision statement. The Fox Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship is a welcoming, vital, and diverse community. We are guided by our Unitarian Universalist principles, which challenge us to grow in mind and in spirit and inspire us to build a better world. We share our story in the wider community and invite those who share our vision to join us. We are a deeply committed community where values and action matter. No doubt I'm biased, but I have the sense that we are making some progress toward fulfilling this vision. Indeed, this fall, our plate is full of things that I think are moving us forward. We are working on becoming a more welcoming and vital community, for example, by addressing the space constraints here at the Fellowship. We have outgrown our space. The result is the building is in some ways now an impediment to realizing our vision. At some services, there's not enough room to be welcoming to everybody, especially to newcomers who are often more sensitive to the perception that there's not enough space for them. We also do not have enough space for all of our programs or for outside activities in the community that people would like to have take place here. We do not have adequate space for fellowship or office space. So we are addressing some of these space impediments through the capital campaign. That's the whole point of this building project. Thankfully, though, this is not the only focus of the fellowship this fall. Unlike really 15 years ago when we had a capital campaign for this building, with the 200 members or so, we really had to focus almost everything we had on that campaign. But this fall, a lot of other things are going on. We've completely revisioned how we do adult programming, social justice ministry, youth group, to name a few. In fact, lately I was talking with a few people and with a few of our youth group members about the social justice changes. And one of the youth group members, after a while, said, "Wow, so youth group, Wellspring, capital campaign, social justice ministry, we're remodeling a lot more than the building." Absolutely. And all of it is meant to better fulfill our mission. Here's the thing, though. All of these changes involve change. Kind of an obvious thing to say, but worth lifting up, because change is not easy for us human beings. Diane Ackerman puts it well when she writes, "Our brain is much better at changing the world than living with that change." It is so true, and seems to me to be especially true in religious community. I know many congregations where keeping the status quo trumps everything: vision, mission, principles, values. So often, what we seek in life, and maybe especially in a religious community, is safety. One expert said, church expert said, "The safest place for ships is in the harbor, but that's not why ships were built." So we would like our religious communities to feel like a harbor, a place we can go that feels safe and renewing. But it's important for a religious community not to take on that mission in the way it lives out its life in the world, to always stay in the harbor, to never take risks, to never risk change. I know of a church quite well that hasn't had a change in its order of service in 60 years. That's kind of remarkable, and to me, the order of service when I go there now feels calcified. And I think calcify is a great word for this process. Borrowed from physiology, it means to become rigid or intransigent. The order of service in this particular church is not the only thing that feels calcified. Many aspects of the church feel calcified. I think a lot of times newcomers must come in and think, "Am I at a museum?" Because it feels more like that than a vital religious community. The congregation has lost all of its ability to be agile, to adapt. And not coincidentally, over the last 40 years, this church has lost 2/3 of its membership. And here's an irony for a church where maintaining the status quo is the ultimate good. Inevitably, that results in a declining membership and a declining financial base, and those two things force all sorts of unwanted changes. Maintaining the status quo is ultimately impossible for a church. Either it is growing or it is declining. And I suspect that's true of many of us in our own lives. We cannot maintain the status quo. We are either growing as people or we are declining. The story, thankfully, is quite different here at this fellowship from this church I just shared about. And I have to say, I'm so glad about that. For longer than I've been here, more than 20 years, this fellowship has embraced growth. This may be one of the biggest reasons why we have grown so dramatically, so that we are now the 25th largest UU congregation in the United States, and with 11 more members, we'll be in the top 20. Many congregations say they want to grow, but they don't really mean it. What they say and what they really mean is, we want to grow as long as that doesn't mean anything changes, and that's impossible. What's different here is that when we said we wanted to embrace growth, we meant it. We said we cannot put up a full sign and lock the doors because we know there are so many other people out in the Fox Valley who would like to be here, who would benefit from being here. So we are committed to growing and the changes that inevitably result from growth. Our growth these past two decades has led to a lot of great things, beginning with all the people who have found us in that period of time. Just a show of hands here, if you wouldn't mind. Who is new here in the last 20 years? Newly visiting, joining, whatever. Okay, look around. Who was here 20 years ago? Okay, so those of us who are here, look around. These are the faces of growth. This is why we've grown. And I have to say, I'm really delighted to have all of you here joining us in this community. I think there's so much good that comes from it for us, hopefully for you, and I think for the Fox Valley. I have to believe that with seven times as many members, we are able to make an even deeper impact on this community. But the changes that have been necessitated by this growth also include some losses. And I'm not sure that I've lifted that up enough from this pulpit. Part of the reason we human beings struggle with change is because it brings gain, but it also brings loss. One that comes to mind here is that for those of us who've been around for 20 years and more, we can't know each other, we can't all know each other in the same way now as when we had 100 members. That's a fact. And I think there's a sense of loss in that. Last month, Terry Dawson, a member of our fellowship, thanks for letting me use this, Terry, shared in a testimonial how he struggled when we moved into this new space. He missed some of the intimate community in our old space, the coffee mug rack in the sanctuary, the beer available in the refrigerator for maintenance volunteers, the ad hoc coffee making. It happened. If people made it happen, usually it did. Maybe once in a while it didn't. A smaller staff, just one, when Terry and Marcia joined. But then Terry looked around and he noticed all the people who have found this fellowship since we moved to this location. And he could not begrudge any of them a place among us. That's why Terry has volunteered to be co-chair of our building expansion committee. There's loss, but there's so much gain. So we honor the loss, and we still keep moving forward. In addition to loss, there's another feeling that often accompanies change, and that is the feeling of anxiety. With the pace of change quickening here at the fellowship, I think we're in a time of heightened anxiety. It makes sense. The capital campaign, all the money that's involved in that makes people anxious. So does changing things like joys and concerns and youth group, the way we do that, and social justice, and our adult education, all those things can create anxiety. We're also here in the middle of a size transition. Another one, yet another one. The UUA, UU Association, talks about size of congregations, that there's a large size, but it's divided into two subgroups, 550 to 750 members and 750 plus. We're at about 660 right now, but we're on a trajectory to be in that large, large category in a couple years. And we know that these size transitions are very tricky territory. They necessitate a lot of change. They require us to be agile. They're difficult. We're also relatively new in a different system of governance. And our new governance puts long-range planning and policies, monitoring how we're doing, in the hands of the governing board. And it puts the day-to-day operation in the hands mostly of the staff, with a lot of volunteers supporting that. That's a really big change. When I think about when I came, for example, there was a services committee in charge of our services, and I basically supported that group, worked for that group in a way with the services. Now I'm in charge of that group. They report to me, and the group has become more of a behind-the-scenes logistical sort of group, rather than looking at the big picture of our worship life. That job now belongs to Dottie and to me. The fellowship chose this new way of governing because it works better for a large congregation, but it is a change, and that change can cause anxiety. Another source of anxiety in recent months was my announcement that I am planning to go on a sabbatical for the first part of 2012, a sabbatical in London. And Dottie has not talked about it yet, but I know from her letter of agreement that she is due for a sabbatical after mine. So the prospect of one of our ministers being gone for an extended period of time causes anxiety. For other staff, for many members, that's a big deal. A final source of anxiety, for the staff at least, is that as we continue to grow, we staff are increasingly stretched thin. Basically, we have the same staffing level now that we had when we had 450 members. And I think we can make it for the next few years, but we are stretched thin. And this means there are some things that we would like to do that we probably ought to be doing that we cannot do. And that causes feelings of anxiety. I want to spend a little time talking about the implications of this for Dottie and for me as your ministers. We've come to the realization lately that we have compounded this being stretched too thin by over-functioning. We've in too many ways made ourselves indispensable to too much that goes on here. And there's two results from that. The first is that we actually become the brakes holding back the fellowship. The second is that we work too many hours. And I want to assure you that this is not your fault. We accept responsibility. We've taken on too much. Because we love this job. We love this place. There's lots of great stuff to be doing, and just gradually, we took on too much. So we are now committed to being much more intentional and disciplined about keeping our hours reasonable and life-giving rather than life-sucking. And we figure if we can keep our calendars reasonable, then our over-functioning will, by necessity, diminish. So we're sharing in the newsletter article for December that each week we want to work a maximum of 12 segments of the day. So a segment of the day is morning, afternoon, or evening. So 12 segments during the week. Generally, we work 4 weekdays, morning and afternoon, and that's important time. During that time, we do things like plan services and Wellspring programs. We write sermons, newsletter articles. We tend to a lot of administrative issues, membership especially for Dottie and program related for me. We wade through email, a lot of it. We meet with each other, with staff, with lay leaders, with the executive team. We make pastoral calls and visits in the hospital and people's homes. And we tend to the denominational assignments that we have taken on. So if we work four days, morning and afternoon, that's eight segments of the week. That leaves four. We're usually here Saturday afternoon and Sunday morning for services, and that's important. So that now leaves two. For evening meetings, for Saturday morning or evening programs, for last-minute sermon preparation, for those pastoral visits that need to happen not during weekdays. And this is the area where we get carried away. This is the area where it goes from instead of two to three to four to five to six segments of the week, of the day. So we've decided we need to be more attentive to this. And the result of this attentiveness will be that you will not see us together as much at non-service functions. And sometimes if you need to meet with us and it's not an emergency, we may have to schedule a few weeks out. Or we may refer you to a lay minister if that's appropriate. And I'm not saying this to discourage anyone from contacting us, especially in a crisis. To the contrary, I actually hope and think that lightening up the rest of our schedule will allow us to better respond to crises as they arise. So don't hesitate to contact us. The conversation we've had about this in recent weeks reminded me of an experience I had kind of early in my ministry that I didn't pay enough attention to. I attended a workshop sponsored by the UU Ministers Association for Ministers, and a minister of a congregation that had rapidly grown from about 100 to 800 presented the workshop about how that happened. At the end of the workshop, when there was a Q&A period, I said, "Well, how many hours do you work in an average week?" His answer was clear, and it was belittling. "How can you ask that question? That's ridiculous. If you're going to be the minister of a growing church, you got to work 70 or 80 hours a week. There's no other way." And he went on to say that to renew himself, someone in the congregation would finance a trip to Puerto Rico twice a year for a long weekend. Well, this guy was in his late 40s, the age I am now. He was in terrible physical shape, and he dropped dead within 2 years of that conversation of a heart attack. His congregation now has under 400 people. He overfunctioned. He overworked. He died. Half of his congregation melted away. For a lot of reasons, this is not a formula I would like to emulate. And further, I believe it's possible, I believe it's desirable for ministers in a large congregation to work reasonable hours and for the congregation to thrive. And that's what we are determined to do. In doing so, we are truly being countercultural when we look around for role models in large congregations doing this. There aren't a lot. I believe, though, it's better for us, better for the fellowship. Dottie did recently hear a much wiser UU minister in a large church observe that at some point, overworking really is just a lack of faith. And I really like that. At some point, overworking really is just a lack of faith. I think that's true with anything we do, not just this work. My overworking here shows a lack of faith in other staff, in volunteers here at the fellowship, in the strength of the fellowship, I think in our Unitarian Universalist principles. The truth is, the fellowship and Unitarian Universalism will be fine, thank you, without me sacrificing everything I have for it. I'm not that important. Neither is Dottie. Nobody is. And someday, I'm not saying when, but someday, I will not be a minister here. One of four things will happen. I will either quit, you'll get rid of me, I'll retire, or I'll die. I guarantee one of those four things will happen. And if I have made myself indispensable, then that period after I leave will be incredibly rocky, much rockier than it needs to be. And to me, that would be one of the most significant indictments of my ministry. So stepping back from overfunctioning is something that Dottie and I can do to help this fellowship thrive for the long haul. One of the things you can do is understand as we do so. But there's some other things we can all do together to keep rolling with the changes. One is to honor and acknowledge the losses that accompany the change. We need to acknowledge those. We need to honor those, even as we keep moving forward. We can also keep our eyes on the prize, which is fulfilling the vision and the mission of the fellowship. We can strive to stay agile and adaptive as the changes keep rolling. And I have to say, there's going to be some things you don't like. And it's great to let your opinions be known directly to the people who should hear them. And your opinion may result in some tweaking, maybe a change, or maybe not. And what I'd say is, if there's something you don't like, just remember, in a dynamic community such as this, it probably won't look the same in 5 years anyway. Let's try to make sure nothing gets calcified here. Let's stay agile and adaptive. Another thing we can all do is stay true to our principles, and especially the statement, principles for a healthy congregation that we as a congregation adopted. These principles talk about how we want to be with each other, how we want to communicate directly, honor each other, listen to each other, stay in dialogue. If you haven't seen these in a while or have never seen them, look on our website. They're there, and they're really helpful. Another thing, if you're not engaged in a small group, think about getting engaged in a small group. That is where the intimacy is here, as our fellowship is now large. And finally, we can all stay mindful of the long term. What can we do today to help make sure the fellowship is thriving 7 generations from now? That's a question I take really seriously. You and I may not agree on how we answer that question, and I may be wrong sometimes, but please know that my decisions here are really guided by that question. I don't want a fellowship that fades away 20 years from now or 50 years from now. As I look at our fellowship today and 55 years since it was founded, I think we're just beginning. We have a long ways to go on our journey, and there's going to be more growth, more change, more gain, and more loss. What I hope is that we keep traveling together. Come, travel with me. However sweet these laid-up stores, however convenient this dwelling, we cannot remain here. However sheltered this port, and however calm these waters, we must not anchor here. Together, the inducements shall be greater. We will sail pathless and wild seas. We will go where winds blow, waves dash, and the Yankee Clipper speeds by under full sail. Forward, after the great companions, and to belong to them, they too are on the road. Onward, to that which is endless, as it was beginningless, to undergo much, tramps of days, rests of nights. To see nothing anywhere but what you may reach it and pass it, to look up and or down no road but it stretches and waits for you, to know the universe itself as a road, as many roads, as roads for traveling souls. Song for the Open Road by Walt Whitman.